Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis. How are you?
I'm well.
Yeah?
I'm well.
But really well or just a little bit well?
No, I'm well. But I wanted to talk today about, you know, all right, here's the deal. What I'd like to talk about today is cocktails. And later on in the show, we're going to have a very light show about cocktails. We're going to talk with Julie Reiner.
I love cocktails.
Oh, I love cocktails as well. And Julie Reiner is one of the top mixologists slash cocktailians in the country. She has a bar in New York called the Flatiron Lounge, and she's great. So we're going to talk to her about cocktails and about bars and about, you know, what it is to be a bartender. It's going to be a lot of fun.
I know today we're going to talk in this segment about an article that Michael Pollan wrote, so maybe we should have four or five cocktails before we talk about
it. Yeah, yeah. Michael Pollan's a very serious writer. He's got a couple of great books out there. He's got a number of great books out there. Omnivore's Dilemma is my favorite, but he wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times. It wasn't an op-ed piece, actually. It was a full-on article in the Times about agriculture in this country. And he is non-hysterical. He's very well-reasoned, well-researched, and he's a tremendous writer.
He sounds an alarm without being alarmist.
And one of the things he talks about is something we talk about all the time. It is about how people are trying to change the definition of words.
Mm-hmm.
So people are trying to take the word, organic. For a long time, the major food houses and food factories and giant agribusiness concerns made fun of and mocked organic agriculture as, you know, the purview of hippies making mediocre beige food. And
right. Make your hemp clothes and organic food and off you go.
And it wouldn't be very good and only a hippie would eat it. Well, then those hippies have convinced a bunch of us that, you know what, it's the right way to grow food.
You know, and I just want to talk about this for just one second on a lighter note. My wife and I belong to this organic co-op called Purple Dragon, and eventually we'll have somebody on from Purple Dragon. And we get organic produce from them. Well, you know, you go to the regular supermarket, especially, you know, when it's cold out, and you pick up, you know, sometimes they have organic, sometimes they don't. You pick up some fruit. I'm going to tell you that the difference in the fruit from the organic that we're getting from Purple Dragon co-op compared to what you buy in your supermarkets, it's ridiculous. The difference in flavor profile, and that's what I'm talking about right now, the flavors of the fruit are ridiculous. I mean, compared to what you buy in your supermarket. Now, granted, even if you go to an inorganic roadside market and you go to a better place, you're going to get better fruit than you get in the co-op. But what I'm telling you is that my experience...
You mean better fruit than you're going to get in the supermarket.
Right. My experience in my life, organic food tastes better, okay? It tastes better, and I don't care if it's only because they're paying closer attention. What I can tell you is most of the organic food I have in my life tastes better than food that's not that's inorganic.
Now,
or inorganically grown.
The shift that's happened is that Whole Foods has proven there's a huge amount of money to be made because a lot of us want organic produce. Well, one of the ways that industry reacts, and I think this is positive, is they start to make or grow or create a conduit for organic produce. Sadly, the other way that large agribusiness tries to get on this train, tries to ride this train, the money train, is to define the term down, is to say, well, we want to change the organic regulations to where it allows these 35 things that aren't organic, but only 10%. You know, I'm pulling those numbers.
Right. Organic food has to have 75% organic materials or organic ingredients in it. Those kinds of dilutions.
And, you know, there were always some exceptions to the organic regulations. If you wanted to have something be certified organic and there was simply something you needed in a small percentage that wasn't available organically, then you would be allowed to use a very tiny percentage of this of various approved substances. Well, they're trying to change that now to where, well, if the organic ingredient would be much more expensive, then... But the idea is to change the meaning of the word. And Pollan brings up, he's talking about some other things. He's talking about the word sustainability. And he says, you know, everything is sustainable these days. And he says, this is a great passage from the article I want to read. When pesticide makers and genetic engineers cloak themselves in the term, he's talking about sustainability, you have to wonder if we haven't succeeded in defining sustainability down, to paraphrase the late Senator Moynihan, and if it will soon possess all the conceptual force of a word like nice. Confucius advised that if we hope to repair what's wrong in the world, we'd best start with the rectification of the names. The corruption of society begins with the failure to call things by their proper names, he maintained, and its renovation begins with the reattachment of words to real things and precise concepts.
You know, smart guy, that Confucius.
So, and then Pollan goes on, and I suggest you look it up at NewYorkTimes.com, NYTimes.com. It's called Our Decrepit Food Factories by Michael Pollan. And he asks, so what about this much-abused pair of names, sustainable and unsustainable? And what he says sustainable means is a practice that can go on forever. There are no inherent contradictions in the practice. So farming, as it was practiced for thousands of years, was sustainable. We could do it forever. Modern agribusiness farming is not sustainable. It will break down at some point. And the problem is, we don't know exactly where and when it will break down, but it cannot continue.
And the problem that we already have is that we're needing to put more in order to maintain the system that we already have, which these large animal factories have become. There needs to be more and more input from us and from outside factors in order to sustain this unsustainable practice. And so we have to ratchet up and ratchet up and ratchet
up.
But here's
the other issue that Mark and I talk about. What we must remember is that sustainable farming and methods of food production are destroyed by unsustainable methods.
Correct.
And can often not be gotten back. So if we fertilize and pesticide and fill the land with chemicals, we can't say at the end, when this type of agriculture stops working well, we'll just go back to the old way, because they're already still out there. The genetically modified crops will already be in the environment. You can't say.
And the pesticides and things that we use on our plants or in our animals will be there, okay? And you can't take them back, okay? They're out in on the land, and then they get washed into our waters. You know, the New York Times did a whole series on what's happening to the fish in our oceans and in our world. And we're losing our populations of wild fish.
Many of the large fish species are at 10% of the levels they were in the ocean in the 1950s. Does that alarm anyone? And the thing about fisheries is, you know, these schools of fish have a place in an ecosystem, and these ecosystems are some of the most complex in the world, because like birds, they fly thousands and tens of thousands of miles. They swim, and what happens is, if you fish them to a certain level, they can no longer compete in their they lose that place in that ecosystem, and then there comes a point where even if you stop fishing, they never recover.
Correct.
Because the ecosystem changes and adapts to them no longer being there.
I promise in the future we'll talk more about this Michael Pollan article and some unbelievable connections that he makes and points out to us that just are flabbergasting. But right now I need a cocktail.
All right, we'll take a quick break. Mark and I are going to have a cocktail. We'll come back and talk with Julie Reiner of the Flatiron Lounge in New York City. I promise you the rest of the show will be fabulous, and we'll come back to the serious stuff another day. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is one of the top mixologists, a.k.a. bartenders, in the country. Julie Reiner is in that rarefied stratosphere of the best mixologists in the country, and her wonderful bar in Manhattan is called the Flatiron Lounge.
Julie, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Hey, you know, we didn't call you on the show just because you own the Flatiron Lounge and we love to go there and have cocktails, but because you know a lot about cocktails. You're really in the forefront of a movement that was started by our mutual mentor, Mr. Dale DeGroff, and we've had a number of the great cocktailians of the country on the show, but you really are on the forefront in New York City. What's that been like, doing cocktails in New York over the last, you know, 8-10 years or so?
It's been really great. When I first moved to New York, I started managing a cocktail lounge in the West Village and started putting out fresh squeezed juice cocktails and really taking a more culinary approach to cocktails. And, at the time, I really didn't realize that anybody cared other than me. The next thing I knew, you know, Dale DeGroff was coming in to check it out, and Audrey Saunders and other people that were really into cocktails. And I realized that there was sort of a cocktail movement that was starting to really blow up, and I just sort of happened to be in the beginning of that 10 years ago. So it's been really great, and it's really fantastic to see more places opening up and more restaurants taking a fresh approach to cocktails.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, you're talking about right now one of the basics of making great cocktails, and that's using fresh juices and using fresh ingredients. And it's almost like I can't believe that everybody doesn't do it. I can't believe that people buy frozen fish, and I can't believe that people buy, margarita mix out of a gun. They're things I just don't understand.
Me too. Yeah, I was honestly kind of stumped when I realized that people weren't actually doing fresh stuff, in New York. And I didn't realize that what I was doing was necessarily that special. Because I moved here from San Francisco, where fresh juice was sort of the norm, even 10, 12 years ago. So it is shocking. And, a cocktail is only going to be as good as the ingredients that you put into it.
You did have a little advantage out there, though. My aunt lives in Santa Cruz, and she has a lemon tree that has lemons all year round on it. So
it's true, but you can order fresh fruit all year round no matter where you're at.
Well,
so I don't think there's any excuse.
Let's talk about, we've talked with a lot of cocktailians about the culinary approach to cocktails, and I do want to get into that a little bit later in the show. But I think that you're involved, your partner's in the Pegu Club with Audrey Saunders, is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Which is one of our favorite bars, and the Flatiron Lounge. One of the things that I think you're particularly qualified to talk about is the place of cocktails in culture, in the evening of going out. Cocktails have gained. People go to cocktail bars now. You're not a great restaurant that has a cocktail program. You are Cocktail Central in both the Pegu Club and the Flatiron Lounge.
Yeah.
Who goes to your bars? That's a different thing. That didn't exist. It's really captured the popular imagination. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, it really has. I think New Yorkers want the best of everything, and it sort of has created a different genre of restaurant to go to. They can go to Pegu and have great cocktails and some food, that they can actually make a meal out of, but it's really about the cocktails. I think it's, people wanted somewhere else to go. The apartments are small, maybe you want to go out and have a cocktail and not spend, $150 on dinner, but you want to go out and have a round of cocktails. You can come in and spend, $30 and have a great evening and still have gotten out of the apartment and gone out and had something interesting.
Though, I also think that there's something that cocktails really have fulfilled a social need, and it's a need that's being, I think, imperfectly filled with, the rage now is small plates, restaurants with small plates, because I think one of the things that's happened is, as we have quite rightly looked at chefs as great creative people who are offering us an experience, if you really want to enjoy Mario Batali's cooking, you've got to go to Babbo or Esco or Lupa and sit down for 2 hours and eat some food. Now, yeah, you can go and have some tapas somewhere at Bar Jamon, maybe. But there's a commitment there, and it's
right.
And it's a commitment of a large piece of time. And it used to be that New Yorkers would go to the theater and stop by a restaurant on the way to the theater, and then, restaurants became increasingly important. But the problem is it's your whole night, and then you've eaten a lot of food, and, you know, what are you going to get? You want to go home and go to bed afterwards.
It's not just a commitment of time, though. It's a commitment of place. You're kind of focused. That's where you're going to spend your entire evening.
Well, and also, when you sit down to dinner, you're going to spend several hours sitting at a table with the people that you went with, talking to them. Whereas I think people want a sort of a convivial, less of a commitment, an ability to go out and have something. And I think that's what small plates approximate, but I think that's what cocktail lounges, people are finding, really fill that role. What do you think, Julie?
I think you're absolutely right. You know, it is a big commitment to go to a restaurant. You're there for 3 hours, and, you know, so yeah, you can come in and stay for a half an hour and have one drink. If you're having a great time, you can stay for 2 hours. I think it's also created a nice little, you know, with more places opening up doing really high quality cocktails, it's given people the ability to sort of hop around town, you know. I mean, let's say you come in, you have a drink at Flatiron, and then you really want to maybe change atmospheres. You go down to Pegu, you have a little bite and another great cocktail, and then you go over to Little Branch or Milk and Honey or any place like that, and you can have sort of an experience where you've hit multiple places.
You know, we need to leave that right there for right now, but when we come back on the other side, I want to talk a little more about that with Julie Reiner. Her bar is Flatiron Lounge in Manhattan. You can link to it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, talking with the owner of the Flatiron Lounge in Manhattan, New York, Julie Reiner, about cocktails. You were talking just before the break, Julie, about the ability to going out for cocktails as opposed to going out for dinner. And everyone, listen, we're not discouraging you from going out to dinner. It's just that sometimes you don't want to go to a place and spend 3 hours there and then maybe go to a second place. Or maybe to add on to your dinner, you'd like to meet somewhere for cocktails and then go somewhere for an after-dinner drink. The idea of
always.
No, you're right. For us, always. But the idea of, like, being a man about town or a person about town, I mean, that very phrase itself has a connotation of being retro, you know. There's really a retro element to cocktails, isn't there? Sort of a retro chic that goes on with the very notion of great cocktails. Do you find?
Yeah, of course. I mean, cocktails pre-prohibition, cocktails were the thing to do. You know, people didn't necessarily go out for dinner quite as much as they went out to have a little nip here and again. So it is sort of a, you know, looking back, I think, to old New York, and there's a glamour that goes along with having a great cocktail. And it's, you know, the social aspect of it, like what you were saying about going to dinner and sitting down with the people that you went there with. Whereas with cocktails, you can go and hang out at the bar with some people, but then mingle with others and have conversation with a great bartender.
Well, and let's call a spade a spade. And if you're there and you realize that you're not really enjoying the people you're with, you can leave.
Yeah.
And go find new people that you might enjoy more.
Exactly.
You know?
Again, the commitment is definitely less.
You know, when we come back on the other side, I want to talk, Julie, with the idea of being, and we'll call it a gender-neutral term, a great barman. I want to talk about how hospitality is different for bartenders than it is for waiters and maitre d's, and how the bartender has a different role in his or her bar, in controlling the social dynamic of it. I think that's something that's always fascinated folks about bartenders.
Yep.
I think you do a great job of it, and I always remember, you know, our mutual friend Dale, and he's the Rainbow Room in New York. You know, kings and princes would walk in and wave to him, and Like, you could see in their face that they wanted, they're thinking, I hope Dale DeGroff remembers my name. You know, it's a very strange thing. But we'll talk about that on the other side. We're going to go to the news right now. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with The Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. To us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today we're talking with Julie Reiner. She's the owner of the Flatiron Lounge in Manhattan and also one of the world's foremost authorities on cocktails. Julie, we were talking before the news about the social aspect of cocktails and cocktail bars, and you certainly have a great place to visit and a couple places that are great to visit that you're involved with, including the Pegu Club. Which is, you know, those are two of my favorite cocktail bars anywhere. But we've talked a lot with the show on the show about hospitality with, you know, world-renowned experts on hospitality like Danny Meyer and great maitre d's like Paul Greco. But the way that hospitality works in a bar or from the bartender occupies a different place in the social dynamic than a waiter or a maitre d' does. At least that's how Mark and I feel. What do you think?
Well, there's certainly a level of respect that people give to the person who's controlling the flow of liquor in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think that the bartender is really an entertainer. People want to have a conversation with the bartender. People want to be entertained. They want the bartender to make them something special for them. And, you know, they sort of become somewhat of a celebrity of the space.
Mm-hmm.
For me, you know, I started out behind the bar and then my role sort of changed as I started opening up more and more places and I'm...
We understand.
Yeah, you know. ultimately, you know, my passion was back there and now I have to sort of pencil in time to be back there. But, you know, our bartenders, yeah, they are celebrities of the Flatiron. People come in, they want to be here when Joe's here, or they want to be here when Adam's here and, they get their favorites, they get attached, and they look to them to entertain.
Well, you know what's funny is I remember Mark and I also started as bartenders, and I have to say, looking back on all the jobs I've ever held, well, I've enjoyed every job I've had just about, that was really at that time for me, you know, and it was 6 years I was behind the bar, well, 7 years I was behind the bar, you know, three to six nights a week. And it was a great job.
I miss it so.
It was a great job. Life was so simple. It was, and we were pretty good bartenders. But what you say about, you know, being the face of the place and being is there's another side to that I think is interesting, and that's sort of being in control of the room. And the bartender has more license to engage people in conversation, but also has more of a responsibility to maintain the tenor of the room. And if someone's acting slightly inappropriately in a bar, it impacts the other patrons at a bar more because it's a social environment. You know, if you're acting a little strange sitting at your table, I don't really care. You know, you have to really be strange to bother the people at the table next to you, then I begin to care. But there is the bartender will inject himself or herself into the social dynamic of the evening to sort of keep people on the rails who might go off the rails.
And I think bartenders are more proprietary about their bar than waiters are about their tables.
But also there's that region where if someone starts to go off the rails, the bartender needs to step in and say, okay, get back on the rails or you're going to go now. And that's, you know, waiters, I mean, as a waiter, you rarely have to do that. As a bartender, depending on where you are, you have to do it at least once in a while, even the nicest of places. And sometimes often.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, for us, Friday and Saturday night, there's always one in the crowd, you know? But what's interesting to me is that people, you know, if you're behind the bar, people will listen to you, you know? And if somebody's yelping out loudly and making a scene and annoying the people around them, and the bartender says, listen, can you just bring it down a notch? They will actually listen and bring it down a notch. Whereas, you know, I've found in the same instance, if I'm on the other side of the bar, I walk up to that same person, they will look at me like, yeah, whatever, what are you going to do?
You know, it's funny, there is, well, because, you know, there is this ingrained in us is this idea that the bartender is, we all know that it's the bartender's job to cut you off if you've had too mm-hmm. much, and nobody wants that.
No, it's true. And, I mean, there are ways of cutting people off that, you know, some people are more skilled than others.
Well, you know, the other thing is it's always you want to diffuse the situation. And if just for all of our listeners, if you're ever out at a bar and you order another gin and tonic and the bartender says, wouldn't you really rather have a cup of tea? That they're saying, I'm not bringing you another gin and tonic. I'm trying to give you a little face here. But the, you know, the universal, just as a funny, tell me if you found this to be true. You've bartended in more cities than I, but there's a universal response when someone who's not quite getting it realizes that they've been cut off. And, you know, it rarely happens at our bar. We rarely have to ask people not to have any more liquor. People are pretty responsible. But, you know, I've been in bars where that's happened. And the universal response is always, and it's something along these lines, while raising your hand at the bartender and having a quizzical look on your face, you always say, what? I'm fine.
Yep.
I'm fine.
Give me another.
But isn't I'm fine the universal? If you say I'm fine, you're probably not fine.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it does happen at Flatiron. And generally what we'll try to, when they order that extra drink, we'll put a glass of water down in front of them first and sort of walk away. And generally, if they've had too much to drink, they don't notice that the bartender hasn't been back. So we start by trying to slow them down before we actually give them the official, you're done. But, you know, yeah, that is generally the reaction of most people. They think that they're fine. And
And they're wrong.
They're wrong, usually. But we have somebody at the door here who is just, you know, I don't know how he does it, but he's able to, after we cut somebody off, exit, get them out the front door, and he'll say to them, you know, I'm glad you had such a good time. You're done for tonight, but come back tomorrow.
And Chin Lane's not very far away.
Exactly. You know, you could come in and have a couple more gin and tonics tomorrow, but tonight, I think you're finished.
You know, to change the subject to the personality of the bartender, I think this is, it's very interesting to me how, and we had a conversation recently with Paul Greco from Hearth and NCMA Restaurant, who was on the show, about how the focus has changed from 20 years ago when people talked about restaurants. They didn't really talk that much about the chef very often, unless it was, you know, some Michelin-starred chef from France in a French restaurant. But it was Cyrio Maccone at Le Cirque. It was, you know, the maitre d' from the Four Seasons or the maitre d' from... They were the people that were talked about as being the face, you know, they were the face of the restaurant, and they had a certain degree of recognition. I won't call it celebrity, I'll call it recognition.
Right.
That's changed over in our culture to where most of the time the recognition goes to the chef who's indeed cooking the food. And sometimes there was this great article about Paul in the Times where it said, you know, out front and often overlooked because, you know, Marco Canora is his chef partner, and most of the writing about Hearth and NCM are about Marco Canora. Another thing that's happening, that's emerging here that I think is, I think it's a good thing, is that great bartenders are becoming, having a certain amount of notoriety or celebrity and getting credit for their work. Bartenders are no longer just anonymous on a certain level. I mean, there's you, there's Audrey, there's Dale, there's David Wunderich and Tony Abuganim. There are, and it's sort of nascent, but I think it's only going to grow. There's a recognition of bartenders as professional, creative people. I mean, you appear on panels, and I've been on shows, and I think that's a good thing, don't you?
I think it's fantastic. You know, it's bringing it into the serious light that it should be in. You know, I mean, it really is an art form, and there are some people that are really doing fantastic things with mixology. I mean, I know I learn from my staff. Something that's been really great for me has been, you know, Flatiron's been open for 5 years now. I have seen people that I have taught, you know, move on and who are becoming celebrity bartenders in their own right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there, it's great to see this see it grow, you know, so it's not just this small group of us that are considered the celebrity bartenders, but there are others who are up and comers, you know.
You know, one of the on a similar note, one of the things Mark and I have recently started is we started a business where people have, you know, we have the two restaurants, but when people will have a party or a corporate event, we'll send a sommelier, whether it's myself or one of our sommeliers on staff, to conduct a wine tasting. It's a lot of fun. People really enjoy it. People have hired us for house parties on the high end and for, you know, big corporate events. But one of the things that we've found that there's a demand for now that we're just doing now is we're sending bartenders to make our cocktails
right,
at people's parties.
Cocktail parties.
And yeah. Or you know, or a cocktail component to your party where you have a bartender who makes maybe an original cocktail or maybe a classic cocktail at your house, and people take it very seriously. It's like having a chef come and cook for you again without the same commitment. So I think that there's an awareness of great cocktails, you know, that's permeating society.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, cocktails are hip and cool, and everybody likes, you know, something sophisticated in a glass, and who doesn't want to have great cocktails at their party at their home? You know, there's definitely been some cocktail catering that's been happening, which is what you're talking about, and you know, and it's been very popular. And I think it's also helping to educate the public on how to make great cocktails at home. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that tough. It surprises me that people are willing to, like, braise short ribs, but yet they won't juice a lime, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. at home. So, you know, I think it's certainly helping to teach people how to do it.
Well, I want to talk with you in a moment. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, about you have another cocktail bar that you're planning on opening shortly, right?
Yes.
All right. Well, if we have to stay tuned and hear where the new next hot cocktail place by Julie Reiner is going to be. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:46. I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953. Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Julie Reiner. She just makes me thirsty. Her bar is called Flatiron Lounge in New York City, and she's about to open a new one in Brooklyn, we hear.
I'm not even going to go there with the she just makes me thirsty. But Julie, tell us about the new place in Brooklyn.
Well, the new place is called The Clover Club. And it's on Smith Street in the Carroll Gardens area of Brooklyn. I moved to Brooklyn about a year and a half, 2 years ago, and realized that, you know, there's nowhere for people to go and have a great cocktail out there. And I decided that I wanted to be the first to give them a really great cocktail joint to go to.
Now, is it going to be just cocktails, a little bit of food?
No, it's going to be food as well. We're doing a small food menu, about 10 items. We will be launching a liquid brunch out there as well on Saturdays and Sundays shortly after opening. And, you know, we'll be focusing a lot on classic cocktails. The Clover Club was a place in Philadelphia that was open from 1882 until the 1920s. And it was a group of journalists that would meet at the Bellevue Hotel and eat and drink. And that was where that cocktail came out of.
Now, you know, I think it's interesting. One of the things that I find really exciting that most people who are into great cocktailians, mixologists do, and we do it in our bar as well, is we have a... You know, you have a certain number of the classic cocktails that you look back into research to see when they were done well, because there was that sort of, it was like the dark ages of the cocktail, you know, from post-prohibition through like the 1970s, where
right.
all mixes came out of a gun or a jar.
Yep.
But there's a mix, I think a healthy balance. To be a great cocktailian, bartender, you need to be able to look back at the classic cocktails and make them well. And you need to be able to invent your own contemporary cocktails because it's a living art.
It is. I mean, to me, I think the best bartenders study the classics and get those down. You know, if you can nail the classics, make a great old-fashioned, a great Manhattan, Brooklyn, you know, mint julep. If you can make those cocktails really well, then you're ready to start creating your own cocktails.
Well, and just like culinarily, there are a bunch of new ingredients coming to us. In the cocktail world, the same thing.
Yeah. Oh, there's new ingredients popping up left and right. You know, you see a lot of agave syrup being used in cocktails today that, 10 years ago I hadn't even heard of agave syrup. There's so many different things that we're working with, and that I see my peers working with. So it's inspiring.
Brief aside, agave syrup is a sweetening agent made from agave, which is the same thing that when fermented and distilled makes tequila or mezcal. What you see, I think we're talking, as long as we're talking about new ingredients, you see a lot of people playing with the sweetened side of things.
Well, 10 years ago, that would have been all simple syrup. It would have just simple sugar, and that's all.
Exactly.
That would have been what we used, and now we have all these other
ingredients.
Yeah. I am the subtitles of the show. Simple syrup is just sugar water, basically, that, you know, fell out of use. But if you want to be a bartender or you want to make great cocktails, you always have to have simple syrup because you sometimes need to adjust the sweetness of drinks that maybe don't even call for sugar, but maybe your limes aren't ripe enough. So you want to have some sweetener at your disposal. It's one of the basic colors that you paint with.
Exactly.
But now I've seen, we use a honey simple syrup, which we make from honey rather than sugar. Agave we see all the time.
Yep.
People are recreating grenadine, which isn't just a sweetener, but true grenadine from pomegranates. So, there are a whole broad range of flavors. And, you know, our prior chef got involved in the creation of our cocktail program 2 years ago. And we spent a lot of time behind the bar with him creating these cocktails. It's the same principles and making drinks that go into making food.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, when I put out new menus at Flatiron, there will be, 50 versions of a single cocktail before it actually makes the menu.
Absolutely.
And that specific recipe is, set in stone. It's not just turning around and grabbing a couple bottles and saying, oh, here's the drink I made for you, which I think is what it used to be. Now people are really taking the time to work through it, which is something that I've learned a great deal of from Audrey, who would come in and say, when I first was starting to do this, and she'd come in and say, I don't think that's ready yet. You need to keep working on that, and really inspired me to work until I came up with the best possible recipe.
You know, it's funny. I have I just share one experience with y'all. You know what? I'm going to edit that out because I'm not going to make it in time. So.
Yeah.
Fortunately, this is a recorded show, so I can go right back to there. So, Jason, knock this out. Well, it is about working just the same as a chef doesn't come up with the dish right away from his head, unless you're Michael Slackus and you're a genius and you do. But most other chefs, they need to work out, what exactly the spicing is going to be, and you try it a number of times. But, I think that's tremendous. I think we'll link to the new place. When's it going to open?
We're about 2 months out.
Well, the Clover Club, when it opens in Brooklyn, we'll let you know. You can link to it on our website.
Julie, I'm looking forward to it. I think that Brooklyn really needs exactly that. The restaurants have kind of pushed their way out into Brooklyn, and now it's time for the cocktail lounges to do the same.
It's a bunch of New Yorkers, a lot of writers, a lot of industry people, and they all really need a great cocktail lounge to go to.
I know. I met some of those people. They really do need a great cocktail. Julie, I have to leave you there. Thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We were talking about trying different cocktails, and, you get an idea for a cocktail, whether it's a twist on a classic or a new idea in your head that's based on, and some of our cocktail ideas come from food that we say, okay, well, that always goes with that traditionally. In getting the proportions right, and with many cocktails, not all, but many cocktails, the proportions being off by 5%, and the drink just doesn't work. You've really got to hit it right.
Absolutely, especially with some of your tinctures or bitters or things like that can be so powerful and totally change a cocktail
and
right on the dime.
And if you're off, you'll make a drink and you say, maybe, but it's just not right. And you don't know exactly what to do. You think, maybe a little bit more green chartreuse. There's an ingredient that if you get it wrong, you're dead. And you think, well, maybe it wasn't that. Maybe a little more acid. Maybe a little more sugar. And you can you adjust it. But the thing, it's not like wine tasting. I can go taste 200 wines in an afternoon. But I remember in the last time we changed over cocktail menus, I had to get it done. And mm-hmm. I spent a day. I got here at 9 o'clock in the morning. And I worked on that. I had the general outline, but I worked on getting those cocktail recipes right. And you joined me in the afternoon.
Yes, I was grateful to join you in the afternoon.
And then at 6 o'clock, I said, Mark, I'm going home. As a matter of fact, I'm not going home. I'm going to the hotel across the street. Because I'd caught a bit of a buzz. Mm-hmm. I really had. But I know, it's hard work, but somebody's got to do it, right? Like, I get paid for that. Do you believe it?
You know, one of the things in dealing with cocktails and all these great new ingredients in it, and we had a young bartender work for us recently, and young chefs run into exactly the same problem. And the thought is sometimes big is more or more is more, and they want to just keep adding these cool new ingredients and smashing them all together and thinking that that's going to come out to be a great cocktail and just kind of experimenting on the fly and here, try this, here, try that. You need to come to this like anything with a sensibility of, well, what do I want this to taste like? Where do I want to get to? And create an outline for your drinks, and just like you would for your food, and not just try and smash too many things all into one cup.
And sometimes, having a lot of ingredients is like having a lot of instruments in an orchestra. You want it to sound like a symphony, not like the orchestra tuning up. Hope you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.